From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today on the program, we're going to talk with an author who argues we've misunderstood the protest and violence that gripped black communities in the 1960s. The idea most people have is that urban riots, or rebellions as some would have them, were a phenomena of the mid-60s and happened largely in major cities, from Harlem in 64 to the long hot summer of 67 to the aftermath of April 4th, 1968.
Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee.
In the CBS newsroom in New York, it's difficult to keep track of all the cities where sporadic violence has occurred in Negro sections since the bullet of the unknown white gunman cut down the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King in Memphis, Tennessee, yesterday.
After the spasm that followed King's assassination, the thinking goes, the riots fizzled out. But my guest today says her research suggests that is far from the case. Rather, she finds that rebellion in black communities spread across the land well into the 1970s, and not just in big cities like Chicago and Detroit, but in smaller towns, too. Here in Illinois, that included Evanston, Champaign-Urbana, Peoria, Springfield, Decatur, and Cairo, among many others. Elizabeth Hinton is a professor of law, history, and African American studies at Yale University. Her latest book is America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. In order to make our schedules meet, I spoke with her late last week, so we're not taking calls for this conversation, but you can always let us know what you thought on Twitter, @21stshow, or by sending an email to talk@21stshow.org. Okay, here now is my conversation with Elizabeth Hinton. Elizabeth Hinton, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
I want to begin by talking about the main conceit of your book, which is that the riots in black neighborhoods beginning in the 60s, and riots is what they were called at the time, are better understood as rebellions. Why do you think it's important to understand the past in this way?
So much of the reason why the problems at the center of this political violence have persisted is because of the misguided terminology that was used to describe them when so-called rioting became a phenomenon in the mid-1960s, beginning with Harlem, after a 15-year-old black high school student was shot by a New York City police officer. And the root causes behind the political violence that we witnessed in thousands of American cities throughout the 1960s and 1970s was shared with the main grievances of the civil rights movement. That is, at base, full political and economic inclusion in American society, an end to police brutality, protection from white supremacist terrorism and violence directed against black communities, but also greater job, educational opportunities, and decent housing. These were the fundamental root causes of the riots, rebellions, the political violence during this period. But in labeling these incidents riots from Harlem onward, which President Lyndon Johnson did, he said, you know, the events that happened in Harlem had nothing to do with civil rights. This is crime. This is tied to juvenile delinquency. It's senseless violence. And in viewing these political actions as criminal, then the only solution becomes more police. Then the only solution becomes calls for law and order and the expansion of law enforcement. And this is a policy cycle that we've been stuck in ever since, that we've responded to these socioeconomic grievances with police and surveillance, and then eventually the expansion of the prison system.
So you talk about the mass public, or maybe I should say the white public at the time, seeing these as criminal. You mentioned Lyndon Johnson's response. You acknowledge in the book, you have a line in there, it can be difficult to imagine the children and teenagers who threw rocks at police or who looted local businesses as political actors, unquote. And you even say that scholars and activists who look at resistance to systemic racism have not necessarily taken seriously the nature of these rebellions. And there are no manifestos or, you know, people standing on soapboxes that we have recordings from that time, or not many anyway. So where do you see these as political collective action and not just, as you were saying, LBJ did, criminal collective action?
Well, you know, you look at one in the communities where rebellions erupted, and let me just say that, you know, much of the research for the book is based on an archive that I happened to gain access to that was put together by the Lemberg Center for the Study of Violence at Brandeis University. Lemberg researchers began their work immediately after John F. Kennedy was assassinated and sought out to document and study both qualitatively and quantitatively violence in the United States during the 1960s, not just the Black rebellions, but the anti-war protests, student movements, labor struggles. And the piece that I use from their records for the book were their kind of systematic gathering of Black rebellions in small cities. And it turned out that that the rebellions persisted, you know, well into the 1970s, which we hadn't previously been able to see, and that they happened across the United States, not just major cities in the Northeast like Detroit and Newark and Washington, D.C., but smaller cities like Peoria, Illinois, and Cairo, Illinois, and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Carver Ranchers, Florida, Phoenix, Arizona, Waterloo, Iowa, you name it. And so part of it is that we have really failed to recognize that, particularly after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., this form of political violence was the most widely adopted form of protest among young people. And in the communities where rebellion emerged, these incidents happened after years, if not decades, of nonviolent direct action protests demanding civil rights gains, you know, the filing of lawsuits, petitions, collective organizing and community mobilization that didn't yield fundamental changes to living conditions. And for many, especially this younger generation who witnessed the civil rights movement unfold and saw conditions change in many ways very little, but with the addition of a new kind of expanded layer of police and surveillance targeted in their communities, you get a cocktail for this type of political violence.
Yeah, and I want to come back, and I think we can explore that connection between the sort of nonviolent civil rights movement and how it morphed into something else in Cairo in particular. But before we get to that, I think most people are familiar with the rebellions or riots in Chicago, of course, that followed in the late 60s. But you note that they also happened in Geneva and Zion and Evanston and Elgin, Summit, Maywood, Harvey, Dixmoor, Blue Island, Chicago Heights, Kankakee, Urbana, Champaign, Decatur, Springfield, Peoria, and of course, Cairo. There's a long timeline at the end of the book, I think 20, 25 pages. I'll be honest, I gave up scanning for Illinois place names midway through 1969. But before we get into some of the specifics that you cover in detail, can you talk a little bit more about the process? You mentioned the archive that you worked with to find this information.
Yeah, so I happened, you know, I was always interested. I mean, one of the central contentions of my first book is that, which is a history of federal crime control policy, is that, you know, Lyndon Johnson and Congress and the federal government launched the war on crime in large part in response to demographic changes and the threat of urban rebellion. And the narrative at the time was that, you know, the rebellions began in 64 when Harlem and Chicago erupted. 67, the long hot summer of 67 was seen as the peak of rebellion, and then they kind of fizzled out after the 100 or so that emerged after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in April 1968. But as I was researching for my first book, I kept on seeing this form of political violence cropping up as the programs of the war on crime were expanding following the enactment of the Safe Streets Act in 68. And I was at a barbecue at Heather Ann Thompson's house, my mentor and close friend and author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Blood in the Water on the Attica Uprising. And she introduced me to a political scientist at Michigan named Christian Davenport, who happened to have the archives of the Lemberg Center in his possession, was doing a quantitative study using their collection of the violence in the 60s. And he was getting ready to do a retrospective. This was in 2016. On the 50-year anniversary of the Detroit Rebellion, we started talking, and he said, "Come, you know, take a look at this archive that I had." And I didn't know quite what to expect. I went into his office and was presented with boxes and boxes and boxes of all of these local newspaper clippings of this violence, this chapter of the Black freedom struggle that we hadn't
known before, in part because historians tend to base their histories off of, you know, the major national newspapers and not as much these local news sources. And also because the Safe Streets Act that I mentioned itself expanded the urban police forces across the country, and not just in, you know, big cities, but also militarized them and equipped them with a host of new weapons, enabling them to suppress so-called riots on their own without needing to call in the National Guard. So, you know, in this later period, summer 68, 69, 70 and beyond, the kind of national coverage earlier in the decade, you know, doesn't exist. And this archive really helped to open up a whole new set of questions about the kind of scale and frequency with which rebellion occurred into the 1970s, and also disrupting, you know, a lot of the narrative that this is mainly a Northeast big city phenomenon. States like Illinois, states like my home state of Michigan, experienced frequent rebellion in both major cities, but in smaller communities as well.
This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Elizabeth Hinton, professor at Yale and author of America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. And let's focus in on Cairo. We have talked on the show in the past about Cairo a little bit, but if you can just remind us, and maybe you can start with the nonviolent protests that began there earlier in the 60s.
Yeah, again, I mean, and Cairo is a really illustrative example in a number of respects, but of this turn towards self-defense, turn towards violent protest as an outgrowth of sets of nonviolent tactics that had been tried by activists earlier in the decade. I think, you know,
I mean, John Lewis himself is there protesting, trying to get the swimming pool desegregated, for example.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Cairo was a really important site for the sit-in movement. And just like a key chapter in the history of civil rights, and, you know, in many ways perfectly encapsulates some of the shifts that the book is trying to deal with, which is, you know, again, how tactics within the mainstream civil rights movement shift in the later part of the decade. You know, within communities, there's of course the kind of growing militancy and the rise of national organizations like the Black Panther Party, but the rebellions in the Lemberg archive, the rebellions that I write about, are much more kind of organic and community-based, and Cairo is a great example of that. It's also, I mean, for me, uncovering the story there and trying to piece together what happened, I mean, it's exceptional in many ways, but also illustrative of the kind of dangers of American racism in general. So, as I'm sure many listeners know, Cairo is at the southernmost tip of the state. And by the early 1960s, there are about 4,000 residents, of which just under half were Black. So Black residents were, you know, did not make a majority, which basically in winner-take-all city council elections meant that they had absolutely no political representation. And just like in many other cities outside of the South, you know, segregation was a very slow process there. I think that there's kind of a myth that, you know, with Brown v. Board, schools, you know, magically desegregated, when in fact this was a process that went well into the 70s, if not the 80s, in many communities, that after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the dismantling of Jim Crow, cities started to integrate. And Cairo is an example of the ways in which the white establishment went to great lengths in order to retain white supremacy. And after essentially a decade of organizing sit-ins and nonviolent protests in an attempt to desegregate the swimming pool in Cairo and the skating rink and the school system, and gain access to jobs for Black residents in the city, increasingly activists turned to militant strategies to realize their goals. And rather than concede to Black demands in the city, again, the white establishment decided to hold on to or preserve the racial hierarchies that had long existed in the small town. So instead of desegregating the swimming pool, authorities closed the swimming pool and filled it with concrete. So none of the children in Cairo had opportunities to swim in the summer. you know, there was a rebellion again during that long hot summer of 67 after a Black soldier on leave from the army was mysteriously died in the county jail. And following that rebellion, the forces of white supremacy in the city really mobilized. And what was particularly devastating and deadly and dangerous about the way that this mob formed in Cairo is that the group, which was originally called the White Hats, was deeply embedded in both the kind of political and economic elites in the city. So, you know, district attorneys and prominent businessmen and city council members, as well as the police department. And in 1969, this white vigilante mob began shooting into the all-Black housing project in Cairo called Pyramid Courts. The white men would stand on the Mississippi levee, which gave a perfect view into the segregated housing project. And one day in late March 69 began to literally just unload their guns on the Black community. And in self-defense, Black residents in Pyramid Courts and throughout the town armed themselves and launched a campaign of self-defense, which the press increasingly portrayed as or tended to portray as a race war, as if, you know, somehow these militant Black residents in Cairo were shooting at innocent white families.
Okay, we need to take a break here. I'm speaking with Yale professor Elizabeth Hinton, author of America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. We're going to continue this conversation after the break. This is The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and my guest today is Elizabeth Hinton. She's a Yale professor and author of America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. The main arguments of the book are that urban rioting in Black communities in the 1960s is better understood not as mere destruction, but as a political act. In other words, rebellion. She's also shown that it was far more widespread and lasted many more years than was generally previously understood. Before the break, we were talking about the situation in Cairo, Illinois, where largely peaceful civil rights demands in the early 60s among Black residents were met with violence by the white establishment. Eventually, that took the form of white people taking up positions on a levee and shooting into a nearby Black public housing complex. We're going to pick up with Hinton where we left off just before the break. She was explaining that uncovering that story was not easy, since news clippings from the era did not give an accurate picture of what was happening.
The news clippings that were available about the story of what happened there, you know, really kind of followed that side of the media's depiction that the Black community there were the perpetrators and that it was tied to kind of a larger revolutionary movement. And I had to do a lot more outside research. And there's a wonderful book called Faith in Black Power by Carrie Pimblatt, which was super helpful to me for those who were interested in a kind of a longer sustained discussion of Cairo.
I'll mention we also spoke with Carrie Pimblatt as well as Robbie Cohen on our program here. You can find that on our website back in January about that book and about what happened in Cairo. And Robbie talked about, I can't remember if it was her mother or grandmother having to sleep in a bathtub
right. As
bullets were coming in.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, and again, that's a story that doesn't get told. When you have a group of white vigilantes shooting into the community, you arm yourselves in protection, but also like you put your children in the bathtub to protect them from the gunshots coming in. I mean, you know, the shootings happened for hundreds and hundreds of nights. And so, you know, there was a mobilization for self-defense alongside, again, the continuation of the nonviolent protest tactics that Black residents in Cairo had embraced throughout the 1960s, you know, essentially under the leadership of Charles Cohen, Robbie's father, the great civil rights warrior and activist. Black residents in Cairo organized the boycott. They essentially said, okay, they were locked out of ownership of businesses in the city. And they said, well, we're no longer going to patronize these white stores in order for the owners to buy bullets to shoot at us. And so the violence, you know, the confrontations between the the White Hats, which became a group known as the UCCA, and the police department and Black residents in Cairo continued for years, of course, because there was no recourse. Black residents had no recourse because of the deep entanglement between the white establishment and the police department.
And this is an example of where you talk about, yes, there was violence, but there were also these demands of the businesses in town. Give us jobs, you know, something other than janitor. And this is where you say a lot of the understanding at the time overlooked this, you know, there were demands. It wasn't just sort of violence for the sake of violence or destruction for the sake of destruction, as it was often portrayed or understood.
Right. There were demands, and there were continued lawsuits with the assistance of various civil rights lawyers who came to the city to continue to press for desegregation, to press for police protection, and to bail Black residents out when they were arbitrarily arrested. And so the story here is exceptional in the and it is, you know, in many ways the longest rebellion and most protracted rebellion of this period, lasting essentially from 69 through 72. But it also, again, is a warning to all of us about the, you know, where we'll end up if we embrace white supremacy over extending equal rights and a fully inclusive society. You know, I mentioned this in the case of the swimming pool, but rather than concede to the United Front or the Black residents in Cairo, the white establishment ultimately decided to hold on to white supremacy. As a result, 17 of the businesses closed in Cairo. The economy tanked. Anybody who had the means or the mobility to move did. And the city is now majority Black. And this, again, you know, really shows us that racism is bad for everyone. You know, this, like, none of the kids got to swim in the swimming pool. And making those concessions, actually trying to build a more inclusive Cairo, one wonders where the town would be today. And again, it's a warning. If we privilege white supremacy over equality, you know, that's going to mean the death of all of us.
I want to move up to Peoria. And there was something particular about your coverage of the Peoria rebellions that jumped out at me that I want to ask you about. I think it was in Peoria. The residents of a public housing project there in one of these events were attacking the management office of the complex. Mm-hmm. And you talk a lot about the role of public housing and the deterioration of public housing, how governments neglected it. I think this is one of those things, though, that to outsiders appears more incomprehensible, why people are doing this to their own residents. Can you talk about what that situation was?
Yeah. So again, I think this really, you know, this is one example that helps us underscore the political nature of this form of violent protests and housing projects in particular as a site of concentrated poverty and a place where, you know, certainly by the late 1960s, many housing projects across the country, including the Taft Homes in Peoria, where a number of rebellions occurred in the late 60s, hadn't been maintained after they were constructed in the 1940s. So, you know, two decades later, they're dilapidated. There are rats and roaches in people's apartments, and public housing authorities aren't working to maintain decent living conditions for residents. The larger rebellion in the Taft Homes, I mean, there were several, started after the housing authority decided to enlist the police to evict two Black mothers and their children from the housing project. Literally, you know, the police came and moved all of the contents of their apartments out into the street. And the residents responded by, once the police left, moving all of the furniture back in the apartments. The police returned to then take the furniture out again and throw it in a dump truck. And from there, residents began to throw rocks at the police, and then the police called for backup. This is a very kind of typical pattern of rebellion, what I call the cycle that we see unfold within as a response to police violence on the part of community members. And, you know, eventually, as that police violence escalated and arrests were made, residents then turned to burning, as you said, Brian, the main administrative building of the housing project itself. I think this reflects, too, the frustration of a lack of, despite demands, despite calls to improve, you know, and keep up the apartments within housing projects, continued neglect by authorities then leads to, and the experience of what could be seen as violent conditions to live in, then precipitates a kind of community violence directed against the housing authorities themselves. And, you know, we see throughout the rebellions, you know, similar burnings of institutions and businesses that are seen as repressive and exclusionary. But I think it's also very telling that in Peoria and in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and other cities, where when rebellion erupted in housing projects, residents very often turned to, you know, what is seen as exclusionary institutions within the public housing authority itself as a target of violence, and Peoria was no exception.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Hinton, Yale professor, author of America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. We're taping this conversation ahead of time to make our schedules meet. Often, though, in our program, we do take calls. And I'm imagining somebody calling right now and saying, you know what? Crime is crime. It's terrible that police are abusing citizens, but you should not destroy property, you should not steal. How do you respond to that argument? This is something you still hear about the protest movements in the last year or two.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, while nobody is condoning these tactics, I think that a lot of times when we emphasize the violence on the part of the participants rather than the root causes, we really limit the kind of possibilities for discussion and change. And this is something that the Kerner Commission pointed out in 1968, you know, in the middle of the Detroit Rebellion, Johnson called for a presidential task force to investigate the causes and solutions to the unrest. And
I want to just point out another Illinois connection. Former Illinois yes. Governor Otto Kerner was in charge yes. of this commission, and it came to have his name. This is a road not taken, right?
Right, exactly. And I think a discussion not taken, too, because the Kerner Commission and one that Johnson himself was very uncomfortable with, because he refused to publicly comment on the report ever, despite the fact that, you know, when it was released in 1968, the Kerner Commission's report became almost an instant bestseller. It sold millions of copies. And the famous lines are that America is moving towards two societies, one Black, one white, separate and unequal, really drawing attention not to the burning and property destruction and looting, but really trying to draw the American public's attention to white racism as a precipitating factor, and made a number of recommendations that said, okay, if we really want to prevent continued violence in our cities, then we need to go far beyond the war on poverty. We need to make a major structural intervention. We need to invest resources in low-income communities of color that are susceptible to so-called rioting. You know, people are demanding jobs and expanded educational opportunities and decent housing, better public housing, and an end to the kind of practices of slum landlords and the really dilapidated homes that many Black communities were experiencing it in this moment. And, you know, in that larger transformation never happened. And, you know, as you said, like, you have to wonder what things would look like today. I think that the conversation about the tactics of protest themselves, and again, the emphasis on criminality, really gets us away from what could be a more meaningful set of domestic policy responses.
Yeah, you have this line I marked in the book. The commission warned federal policymakers and the nation that absent a massive investment into poor Black communities, rebellion and white retaliation would entrench racial inequality as a permanent feature of American life. We only have a few minutes remaining. I want to ask you, you acknowledge near the end of the book this resistance to the idea of defunding the police by many Americans across the political spectrum. It's going to be a long time if something like that is going to happen. But I want to ask you, if in 20 years or 30 years, American cities have found a new model for public safety, let's say they send social workers and crisis counselors instead of armed police officers to respond to calls, how do you think we will have gotten there from where we are today?
That's a really great question. I mean, I think we learn from the history of the struggle for social justice and civil rights that, you know, policymakers never do anything out of the goodness of their heart, that it takes protest, that it takes mobilization on the part of the people. And we really need to keep the pressure on. We need to continue protesting. We need to continue calling, writing, petitioning our elected officials to say, we support and want to bring about a different kind of governance, one that you know, is rooted in expanding social welfare opportunities and rooted in treatment and care rather than being rooted in crime control and incarceration, which has been the kind of dominant domestic policy approach to managing racial inequality after the civil rights movement. And I think that's what the protests in the summer of 2020 were really about, a rising generation saying, you know, these policies haven't worked, they're expensive, and now it's time for a different approach to governance, one that can actually keep communities safer and save lives. And that is much more humane. And again, you know, going back to that lesson from Caro, one that stands to benefit all of us, even if many of us see a more kind of expansive set of benefits or a redistribution of resources as being antithetical to their own interests. I think, you know, we need to keep the pressure on through protests. And then it's also to bring about that kind of transformation in domestic policy. It's also a battle of hearts and minds. And that one, you know, especially recently as critical race theory, which essentially means thinking about racism critically, or, you know, discussing the history of racial oppression and exploitation in this country, continues to come under attack. And, you know, I think that is going to be an uphill battle, but I don't think it's an impossible one. I mean, one of the things that's remarkable about the research that I've done on the rise of modern American policing and mass incarceration is that it happened as the result of sets of decisions and incentives led by the federal government in a relatively short period of time. And so the hope is that if we can tip the scales in the other way, we can begin to undo those sets of decisions and create more robust forms of public safety in our communities that, again, stand to benefit all Americans and will help us better realize, you know, the founding principles of the United States, and namely equality.
I think I heard you in another interview talk about having to grapple with, I think the word you used was the shortcomings of the civil rights movement. And you certainly talked earlier about how Caro, you know, what happened in Caro grew out of the failures of the civil rights movement in a way. I wondered, do you think there's too much emphasis on people look at the 1960s, Martin Luther King gives a speech, a couple of bills pass Congress, we can dust our hands and move on?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we really need to reckon and contend with the fact that ultimately the crime control programs, the programs of the war on crime, and then later the war on drugs, ultimately won out and negated many of the gains of the civil rights movement. And since policing and prisons have really functioned as the engine of racial inequality post-civil rights. So I think moving forward, and this is one of the things I really hope readers will take away from the book, that we need to understand and pay more attention to, again, you know, the path's not chosen, but the ways in which the path chosen, and that is, you know, the continued expansion of policing and targeted low-income communities and then eventually incarceration, has brought us to the crossroads that we face today, and in many ways exacerbated racial inequality following the historic dismantling of Jim Crow.
Elizabeth Hinton is the author of America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. I thought I knew a little bit about this. I learned a lot reading it. Elizabeth Hinton, thank you for being with us on the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian.
Coming up, a visit to the Illinois State Museum. You're listening to the 21st. Stay with us.